Session number 12246, Lieutenant Colonel W. Waitman, Reel
33. Lieutenant Colonel W. A. Waitman, Reel 33.
What happened next, Colonel?
My wife, Valerie, and second and third daughters, Alice and Vanessa, and I flew back from Akrotiri to Lynham by Britannia on the 6th of April, 1968. And an uneventful flight back. We stayed one night at RF Lynham in transit. Unfortunately, we were able to all to speak to my wife's mother and father on the telephone because he was desperately ill with cancer. But by the grace of God and good luck, we all had a word with Mr. Fred Tarrant. The following morning, we were waiting for the coach to take us to Swindon Station when I got a call back into the Transit Hotel and took a telephone message from Dr. Branton to say that my father-in-law had died that early that morning. I kept this news from my wife. We got down to Swindon Station and I saw a friend who went round the forces overseas lecturing to the officers on current world affairs, Dr. Ernest Newman of the London School of Economics. So I said to Valerie, we'll nip over and have a word with Ernest. And that took my mind off the loss. We then went by train to London and London to Darlington, where my brother and eldest nephew met us in, and we stayed for a few days at my brother's. After supper, I took my wife for a walk and broke the news to her, which she took very well indeed. We went down to Beverly for the funeral, and then moved into my late mother's house for a month before moving into married quarters at RF Catterick, where I took command of the training wing support flight. This was the flight that provided the backdrop and demonstrations and fatigue men and enemy on various demonstrations and exercises, and all aspects of training support, including transport, the Land Rovers and troop-carrying vehicles. In addition to this, I was Air Cadet Liaison Officer. And shortly after my arrival there, Squadron Leader Philip Gibson, who was Secretary of the RAF Equitation Association, asked me to take that on when he moved up to Vice Chairman. As Air Cadet Liaison Officer, I was responsible for liaison with Durham County Wing and the Cumberland and Westmoreland Wing of the Air Training Corps, and the three schools, Ampleforth College, Bartercastle School, and my own old school, Durham School. When August came, I got 120 cadets each week for 4 weeks. I was ably assisted by Pilot Officer Al Gilchrist and Alistair Gillen, particularly Alistair Gillen, who later went on to become PA to the later Commandant General Air Vice Marshal Donald Pocock. Sadly, Alistair died later with lung cancer. Having contracted skin cancer, it then moved on to his lungs. It was a great loss to the RAF Regiment, leaving a wife, two young children. We threw everything into the cadet training and activities, and I was pleased to see that one cadet flight sergeant, Hooker, from Cromer in Norfolk, come back to the RAF Regiment as a pilot officer before I left the service 2 years later. I am pleased to say that Martin Hooker is now Wing Commander of the Ministry of Defence, but we saw his potential then when shepherding his small team of three cadets on an escape and evasion exercise. But the Norfolk Wing were very, very keen and well led, but we made certain that any sluggards got some salt put on their tails, and that the cadets got maximum activity so that they slept at night and didn't get into trouble in the village or in the barrack rooms.
Were the cadets all attached to the regiment?
For 1 week. They were the Norfolk Wing Air Training Corps from squadrons and flights within the county of Norfolk. The following year, we had 2 Scottish cadet units and 2 English cadet units. But that year, I was training a composite team for the Nijmegen Marches. And we competed in the Nijmegen Marches, and I was told by a Danish colonel that he had told his chief of staff at the final cocktail party that the Irish Regiment team was the best in Nijmegen Marches, or the Vier Dagse, as it's called there, the 4-day marches of 25 miles per day with weapon and equipment. It was the best team in 1969 out of umpteen thousand competitors and several hundred teams, because you can compete as an individual. So I was very busy at RF Catterick with training support flight, and then ultimately I kept an eye on the training wing support flight, but was full-time engaged in officer training on what we call the J courses, the Junior Regiment Officer courses. So with that, and the Nijmegen March training, and air cadet liaison duties, and Honorary Secretary of the RAF Equitation Association, I went down to Cranwell twice to act as starter for hunter trials. I had a very, very busy but fruitful 2 years. And just before I left the exercise on the 1st of January, 1970, New Year's Honours, Group Captain, as he then was, Donald Pocock, put me up for an Air Office Commanding and Chief Commendation, which was granted and signed by the AOC&C Air Chief Marshal Sir Lewis Hodges. I had arranged, prior to leaving the regiment, a year in advance by contacting 4th Parachute Battalion to rejoin them. And the CO, Colonel David Callaghan, said, get back as quick as you can. So I literally left the RAF one day and was back in the army the next with my old number and my original rank of captain. My 12 years in the rank of flight lieutenant counted for increments, so I only got 10 shillings less than a major in the old currency. I got stuck straight in with the training, and as I'd kept current, because Group Captain Pocock allowed me to go to Abingdon twice a year, I kept my parachuting category as qualified. Didn't need a refresher course, and went straight on to balloon and exercise. I damaged one leg on my 4th descent on the Nuns Moor at Newcastle on this balloon programme, which was held on 2 evenings. And eventually, I thought I'd better get an x-ray. So I went to Catterick Military, and they confirmed that the fibula of one of my legs was broken. And the surgeon, Major Paddy Johnston, said no parachuting for 3 or 4 months or whatever. And I said, well, we've got an exercise this weekend. This is my first exercise with D Company. And if I am not there, they'll think I've chickened out. And he said, right, jump if you want, but Bill Prynne will be here to look after you when you're carted in. I went with the company, and we emplaned at Newcastle Airport, dropped on Frog Hill in the Stanford practical training area, the old Stanford battle area near Thetford in Norfolk. I had a very soft landing, what we sometimes describe as landing like a fairy's fart. My leg gave me absolute jip all night, but the following day and subsequently I never had any more bother with it. I was put in command of the company shortly after this. I went to camp with 15 Scottish volunteer parachute battalion commanded by Brigadier Joe Starling, then Colonel Joe Starling, and he gave me a good write-up, and Brigadier Pat O'Kane promoted me on a visit to the drill hall on the spot with the new CO, Lieutenant Colonel Peter Weeks, who I'd been a subaltern with at Aldershot in 1947. So it was good to meet up again with an old colleague and friend who I'm still in touch with at Christmas each year. I had some great times commanding 4 Para D Company after this gap of 17 years when it had been previously B Company of 17 Para. A lot of weeding out to do, a lot of dead wood, which I got shot of. But in the 3 years I was with them, we jumped into France once to meet up with the Maquisard and commemorate the Para assault on Bruneval radar station and capture the radar equipment. I jumped into Denmark in October 1972 on Exercise Ruby Signet with 7 Para RHA group. The 2 Para group went in earlier, and I parachuted in Wales, and we visited 509 Airborne in Germany.
Had there been any marked changes in equipment and training from the time that you'd originally been with them?
The considerable change in the fact that we now had a container supply equipment parachutist, CSPP, container supply personal equipment parachutist, whereas when I'd been in the first time, I just had the old kit bag. But of course, having parachuted with the RAF pararescue force, the RAF regiment element of that rescue force in Cyprus, I was au fait with the kit. And during my 2 years at Catrick at a non-para post, we jumped with the normal container down at Abingdon. In fact, one day we were told just to grab any that were already made up, and I saw one with a trainee officer's name on it, physical fitness officer going through the parachute jumping instructor's course, flying officer Cole. I thought, oh, that'll be well packed. When I got hold of it, I think it got half a stone quarry inside. It was a right old weight to carry. Off the DZ. It's no burden when you're in the air. But I had a jolly good time with 4 Para and E Company, and still passed my battle fitness tests comfortably at the age of 47 with 8 or 9 minutes to spare. Whilst I was on a course at Beaconsfield, I met some chaps, some of whom I knew, who were on the Arabic course prior to going to the Sultan's Armed Forces in Oman, and one or two of them suggested that I might be interested in applying to go as a contract officer, and this I decided to do. And one of the officers I'd met, Colonel Pat Allardyce of the Royal Artillery, was going out to Muscat as defence attaché. So I wrote to him at his home address, and he very kindly sent my letter on to the officer he was taking over from, Colonel Courtney Welsh of the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers and the Special Air Service, who took my letter to General Tim Creasy, who was then Commander of Sultan's Armed Forces, the result of which I was selected for a commission in the Sultan's Armed Forces. And as at that time the salary was about $4,700 a year tax-free, it put us back on the gold standard. However, during a drop on Everly dropping zone on Salisbury Plain with the rigging teams, I met with an accident on the 18th of May. The wind was over the odds, and my colleague, the Battalion Second Command Major Ben Arkle, who jumped number one port as I went number one starboard, had high twists and couldn't steer. And I suddenly found Ben shouting, asking me to steer away. As fast as I steered away, he kept drifting into me. And I kept just pulling down on one lift web to try to get out of his way. And then ultimately, I had to prepare for landing. I landed backwards very heavily, I would think, although I couldn't see it because I was concentrating on the ground and my landing, that his canopy kept bumping mine and taking some of the air from it. As it happened, there were 7 of us injured out of the 18. I got both ankles broken. I knew I was in trouble because they felt very sore. I rolled my parachute up. The Brigade DQ, Major David Canterbury, came across and said, "Are you all right?" I said, "Well, no, I think I've bust my ankles or legs or whatever. Certainly my ankles are on fire." But I said, "I'm going to carry my chute off the DZ," which I did. By signal to Corporal Schofield, he had a smashed shoulder. Several of us got into the ambulance and away we went to Tidmouth Military Hospital. We were x-rayed and my ankles were confirmed as broken and put into plaster. Later that evening, another chap from the parachute regiment, a regular, came to see me because he heard that some paras were injured, and being a great bond of brotherhood among airborne soldiers, he came to see how we were, and we had a good chat. His name was Bernie Mullins, Corporal Bernie Mullins. And he told me that on his last visit to Sharjah, rather than bring a pistol home and get it confiscated, he'd buried it beside an electric pole. And later, the following year, when I was flying occasionally between Kassab in the Musandam and Dubai, I looked to see if I could identify this telegraph pole in a military camp there, but without success, or electric pole. Not so very long ago, about 8 years ago, the said Bernie Mullins was on television in Hawaii, from Hawaii, where he'd gone as a cook, because the silly fellow had finished up joining the IRA. He just didn't know whose side he was on, and then fell out with the IRA and had to skedaddle to Hawaii. I recognised him straight away, both by name and by sight. We were flown back by Charlie 130 to RF Leeming, and I spent a week in Catterick Military Hospital. My plaster casts were redone there, and then I was allowed home. But I got the left plaster off on the 4th of July and the right-hand one on the 10th. The specialist advised me to postpone my joining the Sultan's Armed Forces. I was due to fly out to Oman on the 1st of August, 1973. I rang Kendall's, the Sultan's agents, and one of the Kendall's was puffing and blowing. So I said, "Oh, well, bugger it, I'll go in any case." So I set off by British Airways VC-10 on the 1st of August. I travelled with two other chaps joining SAF for the first time. They were on loan service, a Captain David Williams, the Royal Artillery, and a Welsh Guardsman, Davis, known as Davis 222. On the leg from Bahrain to Muscat, I decided to go and get a wash and brush up at the rear of the aircraft. There weren't many passengers left on by this time. And it was either the leg from Bahrain, Doha, or Dubai, Abu Dhabi, only a short hour's flight from down to Muscat. And having washed and brushed up and been to the toilet, I couldn't get the zip done up on my trousers. And I spent about a quarter of an hour trying to get this damn zip to move. And I thought, well, people want to get in here. So I went back to my seat and I sat there trying to get the zip up without success. There's a lady sitting opposite the other side of the aisle, and I didn't want to draw any attention to myself in rather a sensitive area in case it was taken the wrong way. So when we landed at Seeb International Airport, Muscat, I got off holding my briefcase in front of my fly buttons in case anyone thought that I was up to some form of mischief. Anyway, I discovered my case in a stores compound where it had just been thrown, one shoulder bashed in, already a brand new case which I'd sent on ahead, and I was met by Captain Charlie Butt of the Oman Gendarmerie. David Williams went off to Northern Oman headquarters, and Davis 222 went to the SAF training regiment. We called at SOAFC, the Sultan of Oman's Air Force headquarters at Seeb, a part of the main international airfield, and then back to headquarters Oman Gendarmerie in Seeb Village. I had a good breakfast and settled in. I was nominated to take command of Sur in South Sector of Oman, which is the southeast corner of the Arabian Peninsula. And the gendarmerie was a large regiment and divided up into various sectors. The Palace Sector, Palsec had become the Royal Guard Regiment. South Sector was based on Sur, this port on the southeast corner of Oman. West Sec was based on Bahraimi, adjoining Al Ain and the and Abu Dhabi Emirate. And Sensec was based on Sohar, up the Bartina coast, 2 hours' drive from Seeb. And then Habsec at Abrut on the South Yemen border, which I'll come to later. My move to Sur was delayed because I went down with severe diarrhoea and sickness from prawn cocktail at supper one evening that was off. But then I went on down there by a Land Rover, and it was a six-hour journey because there were no roads. You just went up the Wadi Yuk and across gravel plains, and then several other wadis, the Wadi Batha, parallel to that, and then turned left from Al Carmel, and Sur was 1 hour from Al Carmel. Now that there's a road there, it's 15-20 minutes. Our uniform was a blue and white checked shemagh with the black agal and the Sultan's Armed Forces badge in the centre of the agal. A dark blue Masri shirt and khaki twill trousers and desert boots and blue stable belt. But for operations, we wore a brown and green checked shemagh, tied Omani style, and called an imama, and green shirt, green trousers, boots and putties. The soldiers at that time hadn't got boots. We Brits, both loan service and contract, took our own Brit Army boots with us, the ordinary direct welded sole DMS boot. The soldiers in the gendarmerie wore black chaplets, and on patrol the brown British Army PT shoes, and in one patrol they were cut to ribbons on the rocks of the Jebel. The 500-600, somewhere between 500, possibly 800 British officers and NCOs out there were either loan service or contract, and they were in the training regiment at Galla, about 5 miles from Seeb International Airport, and then commanding the battalions of the regiments, the Jebel Regiment, the Muscat Regiment, the Northern Frontier Regiment. And then in the south, the Dhofar Gendarmerie was renamed Southern Regiment, and also in the south, the Frontier Force. And the Frontier Force and the KJ, Southern Regiment, Katibat Janubia, those two regiments were entirely Baluch. And the Z Independent Company under Major Spike Powell, they were all Baluch. And the Baluch were recruited from the Makran area of Baluchistan, which is part of Pakistan. In fact, that is where the STAN comes from in the name, Pakistan. And the Baluchi boys were very good value. The army commander was General Tim Creasy, a great man, a very great man, nicknamed amusingly, because when he got annoyed he could sound off, he was nicknamed by SOEF as the Wounded Elephant. I had great respect for the man, and proud to say that I went all the way to Bury St Edmunds for his memorial service 5 years ago. Southern Oman Brigade was then called the Dhofar Brigade under the command of Brigadier Jack Fletcher, Dynamite Jack. And sadly, within a couple of years, Brigadier Fletcher was dead from cancer. Northern Oman was commanded by Colonel John Head of the Irish Guards. So we had Northern Oman headquarters at Beit al-Falaj, which was the Sultan's Armed Forces headquarters, based on the old fort at Beit al-Falaj, and the Dhofar Brigade with the headquarters in south, in Salalah. And the battalions rotated between the south and the north, that is to say the Muscat Regiment, the Northern Frontier Regiment, and the Jebra Regiment, every 6 to 9 months. And the Gendarmerie Squadron rotated again about every 3 or 4 months, and moved around, we'll say, from South Sector to Sen Sector at Sohar, or Pen Sector, which was the Masandam Peninsula, with headquarters at Kassab, and one troop, and a troop at Buka on the in the Gulf itself, and one at Bayer, and a reserve troop also at Kassab. So you had squadron headquarters of Pensek, two troops at Kassab, one at Buka and one at Bayer. And then each squadron took it in turns to go to Habrut, where you had your three troops, or platoon equivalent, and another detached troop at Makina Chahan. I was commanding down at Sur for my first 5 months. At that time, a small fishing port on the coast, on the south coast of northern Oman, Al-Ashqara, was believed to be a point where weapons would be brought in illegally, just as they had been earlier in 1972-73 into Sur. The ones in Sur had been kept in four caches that were discovered, and arrested personnel took the intelligence major to the sites. The weapons were recovered in December 72, January 73, after Operation Jason.
Who were the suppliers of the weapon and why?
They came from Aden and were to arm dissidents against the Sultan, who was bringing benevolence into Oman, Sultan Qaboos bin Said bin Taimur al-Busaid, to overthrow the government. And they were members of an organization called PFLOAG, Patriotic Front for the Liberation of Oman and the Arabian Gulf. Prior to my arrival, the Oman Intelligence Service, later renamed Oman Research Department, under Major Tony Hazeldine of the Royal Marines, a very efficient man indeed, who had been in the Gulf during his Royal Navy, Royal Marine career, had a stroke of luck. They turned the surrendered enemy personnel loose in Muscat and Matra to see if he recognised anyone from the PFLOAG organisation, of which he was, had been a member. But this SEP spotted someone who he knew was a commissar. This chap was trailed and then pulled in, he sang, and that snowballed, and others were arrested, including a second lieutenant from my own regiment, Ali Thani Khalif al-Janoudi, Hamid Majid from Sur itself, of the Ordnance Department, and a warrant officer and NCO from the Medical Department. And Operation Jason was launched on the 23rd of December 1972, and a lot of PFLOAG members arrested. And it was in the nick of time, because PFLOAG were due to start bumping off cabinet ministers and army officers on the 1st of January 1973. But most of them were hauled in. And eventually in the May, after trial, under Sharia law, two groups were executed on the SAF Training Regiment Rangers. The third group were reprieved and given life imprisonment by the Sultan. But I would think 12 were shot, six per day on 2 days running. One had to be very careful. I had a Jordanian officer with me who was very, very good, Captain Ahmed Ali Salim. And he said, always keep a guard on the well and keep your door locked at night. We have a saying in Jordan, never go for a walk with an Omani. My chaps went out on routine patrols, and I went out daily myself, except on the Friday, which is the Muslim holy day, Jummah, a holy day and holiday. But we covered vast areas of ground. It was an hour before we reached Al Carmel, a jumping-off point, unless we were doing villages close at hand. And then for 2 or 3 days I was given a boom, which some people call a dhow, but in Oman it's a boom. And I patrolled from this Sultan of Oman Navy boom, the Almantasir, with a rubber dinghy, an outboard motor. And then later on, for 3 or 4 days, we had the Sultan's naval vessel, now his royal yacht, the Sultan's naval vessel Al Said. But it was very, very interesting. We took the first troops down to Al Ashqa, and I left a troop, or what you call a platoon of the infantry, we call it a troop of the gendarmerie, and squadrons instead of companies, and a very old and experienced ex-Jabal Akhtar campaigner, Lieutenant Abdulaziz, an Omani Baluch. The medical orderly that was with him was a chap who I noticed always ate on his own, didn't mix with the other Ganoud or troops. And I'd always been told by my father, if you saw an animal or an individual always on its own, there was something wrong with it. And this was later proved correct. We kept a watchful eye on this fellow, and eventually when he got into disciplinary trouble, drew his rifle, because everyone kept their weapon to hand, and was going to shoot us all.